right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday. Yay, it's Friday, December 8th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a very chilly 28 degrees and crunchy here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Molecular DNA, Molecular / DNA Storage. I had to do that for space purposes. Stem cells, mini brains, tech evils, and addiction. We have been looking at brains and some of the interaction with technologies, them flipping switches, and all the different ways that they can manipulate our gray matter over the last few days, ending up looking at how it causes a chemical imbalance in the brain to have our focus distracted 24/7. Well, we're going to continue along some of those same lines today, looking at the brain, looking at technology, and looking at some of the things that it can cause that might not be favorable for humans in the future. There was a story, this was second to last yesterday, that came out of New York Times. I was really surprised because it was titled, How Evil is Technology? And it looked at children, it looked at depression, it looked at brain chemicals, it looked at the addiction that it causes, and it looked at how your focus, being able to spend time putting your gray matter to use for one specific topic, is so degraded that it is almost impossible to give something your full attention, especially if device is nearby. So I want to finish now the last story that we only got a few sentences into yesterday out of IEEE Spectrum, titled Internet Addiction Creates Imbalance in the Brain. And this is where they had talked about that GABA neurotransmitter, something that I had looked into before, but never in regards to our device addictions. So they discovered in their research that the brain chemical imbalance, they found it using MRIs, an imaging technique that can detect changes in certain metabolites in the brain. And the tool showed that participants with internet addictions compared to the control group had elevated levels of gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA for short, which is a neurotransmitter that has been linked with other addictions and psychiatric disorders. The participants, 19 young people in Korea, the average age of 15, all had been diagnosed with internet and smartphone addictions. Diagnosis of internet addiction typically means that a person uses the internet to the point that it interferes with their daily life. And you see that a lot in children. And participants also had significantly higher scores in depression, anxiety, insomnia, impulsivity, compared to non-addictive teenagers. Now, what's interesting, that impulsivity button is in the prefrontal cortex, where that dopaminergic system is that smart devices interact with. 12 of the addicts were given 9 weeks of an addiction treatment called cognitive behavioral therapy. And after treatment, researchers again measured their GABA levels and found that they had returned to normal. More importantly, the number of hours that the kids spent in front of screens also decreased, and they were able to observe normalization, which is very intriguing. Finding ways to monitor the effects of an addiction treatment, especially some kinds of early indicators, can be very difficult. So to have some kind of biomarker, and that is a key that we are finding a lot in our research. They are working on biomarkers inside of our bodies to be able to utilize technologies to bag and tag our biofunctions to see whether or not we are operating within parameters on a central dashboard somewhere in the future. So you have some kind of biomarker that you extract from an imaging technique that allows you to monitor the effect of the treatment and tell you early on whether or not it's succeeding, and that is extremely valuable. The researcher notes that since there were only 19 people in the study group, The measurements of their GABA levels should be taken with a grain of salt, but a study of a larger population would be needed to draw conclusions about the role of chemicals in internet addictions. I think there's enough out there about dopamine to just show that there is a causal relationship, not even looking at the particulars. The reduction in addiction symptoms, however, is a significant finding because each patient serves as his or her own control, he says. And that's the one thing that I've discovered in studying dopamine in the brain and internet and device addiction is that it actually breaks that ability to have self-control, because that is where the executive functioning occurs, is in that prefrontal cortex. Other research groups have used MRIs to identify structural changes in the brain caused by internet addictions. Some have even observed abnormal white matter as well as shrinkage of brain tissue linked to screen addiction. Continuing such studies is important given the increase in the internet, phone, and tablet use globally and smart cities coming to a city near you. Those devices have become such an integral part of our lives, we might not meet the diagnostic criteria of addiction, but it is something that we all experience to a certain degree. But it gives us a little bit of hope that there are things we can do to get back to normal. Well, yeah, things we can do to get back to normal. Just make sure the neurologists and the neuroscientists don't want to get into your brain to make them all better after they broke them. There was a story that came out of a Singularity Hub, and this was 2 days ago, December 6, 2017. Neuroscientists could bring us eternal bliss, but is that a good thing? Maybe they could push a few buttons or a few flashes of light bzz, bzz, to make you all better. It says, what if the secret to eternal happiness is a brain implant? And I think that is what they are trying to convince us of. If you are thinking that that sounds like a premise of a Black Mirror episode, ha ha ha, you are not alone, because we've also talked about that. And yes, the Society for Neuroscience annual conference earlier this month, and well, that was in November actually, two teams demonstrated a new technology that may one day take us right there. Picture this, a series of tiny electrodes sit silently in various parts of the brain, maybe they are called neural dust, recording the organ's electrical activity in real time. That data is fed into a personalized algorithm, which is a mood map that can estimate a person's general mood based on brainwaves alone. And we had read about an AI implant by DARPA, I believe, that was going to be able to monitor moods in the case of course, PTSD or some sort of traumatic brain injury that causes problems. When the system detects patterns that indicate the onset of a depressive episode, it sends out electrical zaps, bzz, bzz, targeting the brain's mood centers. And under the watchful eye of the algorithm, the system continues to the simulation until the malfunctioning circuits are shocked back into a happy state. And this sounds a lot like some of the work they were doing on that ElectRx program through DARPA, targeting neurons and the vagus nerve. Here, the algorithm is completely in charge, and every zap or tweak happens under the hood, and the system does not need guidance from a physician. Oh, no, autonomous brain zappers, and the person is not aware of the zaps. That is, other than in a general sense of relief from the sadness. Funded by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, scientists are hoping that these futuristic closed-loop implants, and this is ElectRx, may one day help veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder or people with severe depression that do not respond to drug treatments. The brain is very different from all other organs because its networking and its ability, says Justin Sanchez, program manager at DARPA. Real-time, closed-loop neural interfaces allow us to move beyond traditional static views of the brain and into a realm of precision therapy. Remember, this is all about precision medicine. Although the system is aimed at helping people with mental illness soon, which we will all be diagnosed by the sound of our voice with, its potential impact may reach a far wider slice of society. Without a doubt, brain surgery is a high price to pay for simulated happiness, especially for the average person. Yeah, no thanks. Yet it is conceivable that components of the system may eventually be replaced by non-invasive ways to measure and stimulate brain activity, like maybe a skull cap. What happens then? Would you trust others with direct, constant, chronic access to your inner feelings? And would you be tempted to drown out all other emotions with happiness? Well, of course, that is assuming that this system actually works, and the core of the system relies on a decades-old technology called deep brain stimulation. We have talked about that a few times before. First approved for treating movement symptoms in Parkinson's, deep brain stimulation relies on electrodes directly implanted into the brain to deliver electrical pulses. These pulses interact with local neurons and they alter their activity. So like tossing a pebble into a pond on still water, changes to this core group of neurons ripple out across the neural circuits. And although neuron scientists haven't quite figured out the specific mechanisms behind it, the direct brain stimulation seems to provide relief to a slew of neurological disorders, and that is in at least their small scattered trials down deep dark hallways. In a one demonstration of the power of direct brain stimulation, a scientist turned the simulation system on while asking a patient with depression how she felt, and incredibly, the patient only reported feelings of a cloud lifting when the system was turned on, even though she was not aware that the researcher had flipped the switch. This and other early successes have prompted a recent large-scale trial with 90 people with depression. Is that 90 people who they really cracked their skulls to put in electrodes? Because this is crazy. You're depressed? Well, come on, let's get some brain surgery. We'll fix that up for you. The bad news, on average, the study did not find any improvements after a year. Oh, no. But according to Edward Chang, a neuroscientist at the University of California, San Francisco, is leading one of the projects. That is not the end of the story. Like most direct brain stimulation systems that treat depression, whether or not the person exhibits different symptoms, and these systems pound the brain with constant electrical impulses. The stimulation protocol is set by physicians rather than according to the actual patient's brain state. And according to Chang, it is to design implants specifically to treat symptoms tailored to each individual and only turn on when they are needed. Together with Dr. Amnid G. Sani, an electrical engineer at the University of Southern California, the team developed an algorithm that translates brain waves to subjective feelings of mood. So his team worked with 6 patients with epilepsy who already had electrodes implanted to hunt down the source of their seizures. And over a period of 1 to 3 weeks, each team tracked each patient's brain activity in detail while monitoring their mood through a standardized questionnaire. By comparing the two types of information, the team developed an algorithm that extracted a small number of neural predictors, which are dynamic patterns of activity in neural networks that could accurately predict a person's ever-changing feelings. A few hotspots merged, which include our limbic system and previously identified hub for mood regulation and motivation. And that's what the AI is after, is that limbic system to give them emotions. These dynamic mood biomarkers and mood decoding algorithms can provide insight into brain processes underlying mood regulation, concludes Sani. And this is also the first step toward personalized stimulation therapies for depression based on feedback of estimated moods, he adds. According to Nature, Sani and Chang have already developed a prototype system ready for testing in humans. Similarly, closed-loop systems have already been tested in a handful of people, but Chang stresses that these preliminary results need to be further validated. A second team, because remember this is going on all over, led by neurosurgeon Dr. Imad Eskandar and a Massachusetts General Hospital, takes a slightly different approach. Dubbed transdiagnostics, the approach looks at commonalities in different psychiatric disorders rather than a specific mood disorder. And then the team then developed algorithms that capture and distill brain activity associated with these common traits. For example, anxiety, forgetfulness, or lack of empathy. And to Eskandar, brain waves are only a small part of the data. His team also hopes to record the activity from individual neurons in a bid to identify those that go awry in mental illness. And remember, Massachusetts General Hospital is connected to some of the research that they are doing at Harvard and MIT, and that is exactly where the Weiss Institute is with some of this neuronal barcoding with Georgie Porgy Church. Any taste of what could be, and they presented an algorithm at the conference that detects when people are having a lapse in attention. The participants were asked to concentrate on a task, for example, identifying emotions on a computer-generated face while having the brain activity monitored. The algorithm eventually learns to pick out neural activity patterns associated with distraction. So once you get distracted, Johnny, we're going to give you a few zaps and bring you back to focus. So when the team stimulated the volunteers' brains in a region normally responsible for decision-making, and I think that is the prefrontal cortex, their performance in the task markedly improved. So that scatterbrain neural activity pattern also disappeared. Well, I hate to say it, but I think sometimes I could use that as well. The team is now working on automating the process so that the algorithm directly triggers stimulation during lapses in attention. If realized, these DARPA projects would completely transform our treatment of mental illness, but scientists are already working on things that we may be stumbling into an ethical minefield. So are they saying that not having scatterbrain is a mental illness? Because remember, we looked at that before when we first started looking at them digging into the brain and making mental illness part of the 21st Century Cures Act. We started looking how first, it started with PTSD, Alzheimer's, and dementia. And then as the reports went on about some of these projects they were working on, they started expanding that base as to what is defining mental illness. To fully implement these closed-loop systems, the algorithm has to know at all times a person's true feelings. Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is going to fly. And although it doesn't explicitly report mood fluctuations, the data is accessible to researchers and physicians. And if such a treatment is ever commercialized, could patients trust companies to keep their inner feelings safe and private? Well, I would say probably not. They're going to sell it to drug companies to market new and improved drugs to you. Some scientists are also worried what an electric happy pill would mean for a person's sense of self. Just push a button, put on that EEG device called Emotive, and you can dial yourself up or down for your emotional health. And with any treatment of a brain disease, we risk trying to make everyone the same and treat any variation from the norm as sickness. Ding, 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 remarked Dr. Karen Rolfemanger at Emory University with regards to direct brain stimulation. And that's exactly what I've been saying. They're going to be putting you in a dashboard and mapping analytics against what is going on in your head or your body and your liver or your spleen or whatever they're monitoring. And once you go outside of those parameters, bang, you're going to be labeled as somehow ill that they're going to have to find a way to fix. Now, we all want to have magical thinking, and let's add Regina Duggan's superpowers, but are we going to eradicate depression? No, and we shouldn't, because being human means the full spectrum of experiences, Dr. Karen Rolfemanger. It is never too early to begin these conversations, but to Chiang, the near-term benefits, knowing when someone else relapses before going into the full gamut of symptom strikes, already makes the project worthwhile. For the very first time, we are going to have a window on the brain, he says. Well, that is what worries me. All right, so now we're going to go somewhere else. I'm going to make a little right turn just for a few minutes. But a couple times over the last week, the show, and I think I did one, maybe two shows, where Edward, I think his first name was Edward Kaczynski, came up, the Unabomber, and some of his ramblings in his manifesto in regards to technology. And I would like to revisit a little bit of his manifesto today, because a lot of things we discovered in digging into, no, Ted, Edward, his name is Ted Kaczynski, in delving into Ted Kaczynski, was that a lot of the things that they told us on the news absolutely weren't true. I mean, the man was in the woods, and he maybe was a little bit psycho by the time they found him, but he had been a very prestigious mathematician who had been involved at some point along the way from Harvard to the University of California in some of those MK Ultra experiments. They had found his name in a few lists. And they had been tinkering with his brain. He had been babbling about technology and being targeted and all kinds of different things. And I hate to say it, guys, but the more that I learn about this man, the more that I think that this man was onto something. He had been brought up in a story by Bill Joy, who had been, I don't know if he was the founder or one of the CEOs of Oracle, which was a technology company that we used to deal with way back in the beginning days of technology. And Bill Joy wrote a story in the New York Times, I think it was from 1999, called Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. And he had mentioned Ted Kaczynski's manifesto. So let's take a little look at it. And maybe this will lead somewhere. I don't know. I've been researching all kinds of stuff lately. So today is mainly talking about technology in the brain. So this is the full text of, and we're probably not going to read the full text, but we'll read some of it. Industrial Society and Its Future, the Unabomber's Manifesto. And I think this came out somewhere around 1995. His introduction, the Industrial Revolution, and remember we are in the fourth Industrial Revolution, they're calling it, and this is with ubiquitous connectivity and the Internet of Things and robots coming to take all of our jobs. The Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race, and this sounds a lot like some of the things that Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking are warning about. They have greatly increased life expectancy for those of us who have lived in quote-unquote advanced countries. But they have destabilized society, having made life unfulfilling or depressing. Remember, we found out all those chemical changes that happen in the brain cause a lot of depression. And they have subjected human beings to indignities. They have, like people getting posted doing unmentionable things online. And they have led to widespread psychological suffering, or I'm going to say illness, as well as in the third world, to physical suffering as well, and have inflicted severe damage on the natural world. I was watching something by Barry Trower yesterday where he was talking about microwave technology and the telecommunications industry and how they are some of the worst offenders for carbon production and some of the damage that has been happening to the environment unchecked. The continued development of technology will worsen the situation, and it is happening at lightning speed right now. It will certainly subject human beings to greater indignities and inflict greater damage on the natural world, and it will probably lead to a greater societal disruption and psychological suffering. Yes, as all of our children end up mentally ill and needing to be treated by technologies such as DARPA's, and it may lead to an increased physical suffering even in the advanced countries. And that would be when our robot overlords come. Number two, the industrial technological system may survive or it may break down. If it survives, it may eventually achieve a low level of physical and psychological suffering itself, but only after passing through long and very painful periods of adjustment, and only at the cost of permanently reducing human beings and many other living organisms to engineered products, ding, ding, a ding, like, oh, I don't know, genetically modified with switches flipped and super babies and whatever else, super bacteria with X-ray vision and a mere cog in the social machine. Furthermore, if the system survives and we don't destroy ourselves, the consequences will be inevitable. There will be no way of reforming or modifying the system as to prevent it from depriving people of dignity and autonomy. And that's exactly what we are seeing coming in our not-too-distant future. And I don't know what this says, if lie system breaks down and the consequences will still be very painful, but the bigger the system grows, the more disastrous the results if its breakdown happens. And if so, its breakdown will be the best breakdown sooner rather than later. So as we become more dependent, the breakdown of the machine will cause much more social disruption. We therefore advocate a revolution. That is not me. That is Ted Kaczynski. Against the industrial system, my revolution is turning it off and walking away. And the revolution may or may not make use of violence. Well, I do not advocate that at all. All you got to do is turn off that device and go into the woods. and it may be sudden or it may be a relatively gradual process spanning over a few decades, but we cannot predict any of that, he says. But we do outline in very general ways the measure that those who have made the industrial system should take in order to prepare for a revolution against that form or that type of society. And I'm telling you, this Agenda 2030 society that is coming in our future, the planned safe cities that are connected to the artificial intelligence that do pre-crime, like the City Brain Project, that they are doing in Hangzhou, China. If that is any indication as to what is coming, I say turn it off and walk away now. This is not to be a political revolution. Its object will be overt, and not with governments, but with economical and technological basis of the present society. We will give attention to not only some of the negative developments that have grown out of the life of industrial technological system, other such developments we mention only briefly or ignore it altogether. This document is not mean that we regard these other developments as unimportant, but for practical reasons, we have to confine our discussion to areas that have received insufficient public attention or in which we have something new to say. For example, since there are well-developed environmental and wilderness movements, we have written very little about the environmental degradation or the destruction of wild nature, even though we consider these to be highly important. Now we're going to skip over. He goes into the whole lefty mindset as well that is helping push this agenda forward. All right, the next section past that is called Feelings of Inferiority. That would be step aside, Johnny, because the AI is smarter than you in anything you can think or do. By feelings of inferiority, we mean not only inferiority feelings in the strictest sense, but a whole spectrum of related traits, and that would be causing low self-esteem, feelings of powerlessness, depressive tendencies, defeatism, guilt, self-hatred, etc. And we argue that modern leftists tend to have such feelings, possibly more or less repressed, and that these feelings are decisive in determining the direction of modern leftism. So I guess it continued. When someone interprets what someone interprets as derogatory, almost anything that is said about him, we conclude that he has an inferiority feeling or low self-esteem. This tendency is pronounced among minority rights activists, and whether or not they belong to a minority group whose rights are defined, they are hypersensitive about the words used to designate minorities. And this is what we are seeing even today in the leftist movement. Everything that is said, they take personally and make it as an attack against them. So any ones of us who are trying to bring sense to a discussion are shunted and quieted as being influenced by the other side. And I don't really want to read about leftism here. All right, final note. Let's get to the meat and potatoes, though. I know this continues on. Throughout this article, we have made imprecise statements and statements that ought to have all sorts of qualifications and reservations attached to them. But let's fast forward in the future and look at this in the past, and we'll find out that a lot of the statements ring true. A lack of sufficient information and the need for brevity made it impossible for us to formulate all of our assertions more precisely, blah, 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 blah. I don't know. All right. So if you ever get a chance, I will link to it. And there probably is a better version of this in PDF. I was reading something online, and it wasn't actually cleaned up very well. It had a lot of typos in it. So, all right, let's take a next step. So we are looking at how this is influencing our mental behavior and our moods, our feelings of inferiority and potentially depression, how it's going to control and manipulate our lives and make us just small parts of this bigger cog that is coming that will be out of our control. And once it gets too big, it won't be able to be stopped. Well, we had looked at a story back, I don't know, a few days ago out of TechSpot about optogenetics that I had worked on, and it had looked at utilizing light to flip switches in the brain. It can mess with those calcium and sodium ion channels and turn neuron connections on and off. And one of the things, when we were looking at that, we kind of postulated, well, you know, if they could do that with light flashes and using proteins derived from algae to make neurons light sensitive, and then using, in that case, they were using fiber optic cables and implants into the brain to help target those neurons. What would happen if they found a way to literally do it through the eyes? Well, I found a story the other day that I thought was interesting, and this was from 2012, but this also looks at addiction and some of these other technologies that are coming in the not-too-distant future, and that would be virtual reality and VR goggles. This is out of IEEE Spectrum, one of the publications that I like because they do a lot of high-end stuff on robotics and that. Virtual reality, and this is back from 2012, mind you, July 31st, 2012. Virtual reality is addictive and unhealthy. Interactive technologies give us a quick fix, and that is not a good thing. It also takes us into another world where we can escape from our not-so-happy real reality that we want to hide from because it's just a little too difficult to comprehend as to what is actually going on. In my days as an engineer, and that is not me, that is author William H. Davidow, I ran the microprocessor division at Intel. And I then became a venture capitalist, investing in companies that build semiconductors, computers, and networking systems, as well as internet-related services. I focused on products that help businesses run more effectively and gave little thought on how they might affect our minds, our social interactions, and our governance in the future. And I got to tell you, his story echoed a lot of mine because I did a lot of the same thing. I helped a lot of companies and organizations network things together and sold it. I told you I was an evangelist for technology and sold it to them lock, stock, and barrel is how it was the way of the future. And now, it's just like this guy, that lapse in judgment has now come home to me as I see people walking down the street with their eyes fixed on the screens of their mobile phones, their ears plugged into their iPods, and oblivious to their surroundings and to reality itself. And that is exactly how all of this usurpation of our autonomy is happening. They have disconnected everyone and distracted everyone so far that it's making it very easy for them to slip us the willy of AI to run the show and take away our ability to manage our own lives. They are not managing their tools. Their tools are managing them. And these tools are now making the rules, and we are struggling to keep up. I, the author, have spent my career developing and financing companies that supply these profoundly powerful tools. And for the most part, I thought of them as harmless. And I believe my job was simply to make the tools better so that others would use them to improve the world. Well, surprise! It didn't quite work out that way. But only in recent years have I become aware and concerned about their serious side effects. Guys, I really think this is like a come-to-Jesus moment that is beginning to happen to a lot of us that have been in the tech industry. You know, all the stuff that we were behind and we were, I don't know, almost brainwashed into thinking was such a great thing. We were all swept up into the excitement of the industry and how amazing the future was going to be for us, but we did not realize that there were going to be human consequences. And also, this author has decided to study these serious side effects and do his best to explain those side effects to the world. So here's what I have learned. Well, kudos to this guy. So he's on my train. I like anyone that's gotten on my train because this really is a scary thing. And, you know, for any of us who have children who aren't looking at the effects that this is going to have on this next generation, this is very scary for everybody. First of all, it wasn't always this way. And that's what I was talking about. Children in the 70s and the 80s grew up in the before world. And that is the world where we were able to straddle these two realities that we have. You know, we typically grew up in our young childhoods having to wait for Saturday morning cartoons. We did not have an instant gratification society where you could just push a button and make things happen and have our superpowers. And when you were bored, you either helped your parents or you went out to play. You did not sit in front of a device. First of all, it wasn't always this way. Our relationship with tools dates back millions of years, and anthropologists still debate whether it was the intelligence of human apes that enabled them to create tools or the creation of tools that enabled them to become intelligent. In any case, everyone agrees that after those first tools were created, our ancestors' intelligence co-evolved with the tools. And that's part of that, what is called, 2001 Space Odyssey. That's what that whole big slab was about, showing the apes creating tools, that was bringing up the chicken and the egg question. And in the process of our forebears' jaws became weaker, their digestive system slighter, and their brains became heavier. Chimpanzees, genetically close to us though they are, have bodies 2 to 5 times as strong as ours on a relative basis, and brains that are about as quarter as big. In humans, energy that would have gone into other organs instead is used to run energy-hungry brains. And those brains, augmented by tools, make up for more than any diminishment in gut or muscle. And indeed, it has been a great evolutionary trade-off. There are 7 billion people, but only a few 100,000 chimpanzees. In our distant past, our tools improved slowly enough to allow our minds, our bodies, and our family structures, as well as our political organizations, to keep up. And the earliest stone tools, about 2.6 million years ago, were used. And those other tools that then came from those refined and became more sophisticated, our bodies and our minds changed to take advantage of their power. This adaptation was spread over more than 100,000 generations, and so our social structures evolved along with our tools. Then some 10,000 years ago, tribes of roaming hunter-gatherers began to stay in one place to raise crops, and agriculture made cities possible. And when cities came, the arts and commerce came, and as transportation improved, the cities grew, and it became important to control distant places that supplied food and raw materials. After about 6,000 years ago, ancient city-states like Uruk emerged out of Mesopotamia and governed the surrounding countryside. Millennia later, Athens and the largest of Greek city-states controlled about 2,500 square kilometers and most of the Aegean Sea. So far, so good. But don't worry about it, because it gets worse. But with the invention of movable type in the medieval times, followed by other improved ways of connecting, and I think that movable type was the one thing that took the some of the writings into mass print and spreading ideas across the population. Better shipping and roads, trains, planes, automobiles, and the internet. Technology is now raced ahead of us. And in our own time, the most striking example of the acceleration of technology has been Moore's Law, under which the density of transistors on chips has doubled every 18 months. The performance of single processors long rose in tandem with the transistor count. But even after that relationship stalled in the mid-2000s, the switch to devices using many processors kept the performance curve pointing upward, and that would be supercomputing. This exponential rise in capability has augmented the pooling of knowledge from different sources to achieve a creative synthesis described by 19th century mathematician and philosopher Henri Poincaré. Quote, to create consists precisely in not making useless combinations and in making those which are useful and which are only in a small minority. Among those chosen combinations, the most fertile will often be those formed of elements drawn from domains which are far apart, unquote. Drawn in part from the internet, the newly created knowledge gets deposited back on the internet, increasing the scope and acceleration of development of technologies. Burgeoning knowledge, in turn, drives rapid change and advances in technology, transformation in businesses, and changes how markets work and how people interact. Governments, social institutions, and our brains really struggle to keep up. So even the nature of change itself has changed, and living creatures started out evolving in one dimension defined by its physical world and another defined by the biological world. And when it came to humans, who added the third dimension, the artificial one engendered by tools and technologies. So now, with the widespread use of the internet, the fourth dimension has been added, and that is that of virtual reality or cyberspace. It is indeed appropriate to consider this last dimension as real and distinct from the tools and technologies of the past, because however fast those things may have changed, the rate of change in the virtual space is much faster, and it took a lot of time to build the physical infrastructures, the roads, the highways, the bridges, the skyscrapers, and so forth. But in virtual space, entirely new infrastructures can arise overnight, as Google and Facebook have proved. And I now believe that our minds, our bodies, our businesses, our governments, and our social institutions are no longer capable of coping with the rapid rate of social change. And it is obvious that this change is indeed more rapid than any comparable change that came before. And this is echoing some of what Musk and Hawking were talking about and why we could potentially be on the verge of self-destruction. Things are happening way faster than we know, way faster than laws are keeping up, way faster than any overarching institution is able to monitor and make sure that it is being done safely. And this is where folly comes in, because it is all being done to make a quick buck. Think of the many years it took Barnes & Noble to build itself a retail chain of U.S. stores, and the company set up its first bookstore in 1917, and by 2010, it was operating 717 of them. I used to really like going to Barnes & Noble in the day. It took time for the company to find the proper locations, lease them, stock them with inventory, and still more time to build it into a viable business. And the company was limited in what it could do only because certain physical locations were suitable for retail stores. Combine that long history to the rise of Amazon, which started in 1994 and was operating in virtual space throughout the United States by next year, putting a bookstore in every single home that had a connection to the internet. Barnes & Noble responded with an online strategy of its own, which wasn't really very that good, I remember, and one that now gives a pride of place to the sales of ebooks, and the company continues to fight on. Meanwhile, competitors Border was liquidated, and both constitute sterling examples of creative destruction of capitalism, as economist Joseph Schumpeter put it. But the fact that entire business models can come and go that fast is absolutely extraordinary, and it also indicates the challenges that rapid change present to other institutions, and I would say also to the eradication of 50% of all jobs by robots in our future. An example is our financial institutions transformed by the past 20 years by radical innovation. And that's where I had my very first technical job, where I was working on networks, was at an operations center for a Northeastern bank that had dealt with bringing all of their records online. And guys, we've seen that come a very long way. We actually had implemented a barcoding system back in 1991, and I was working one-on-one with a developer out of New York City to be able to make that happen. But we've come a very long way. So for the past 20 years, radical innovations such as the introduction of high-speed trading, in which computers trade securities with other computers and there are no traders involved now, and the immensely complex new investment vehicles known as derivatives. These innovations, enabled by improvements in computing power and telecommunications, have made markets much more volatile and played leading roles in a recent worldwide economic meltdown. And a regulatory framework has failed to keep up. In 2005, about 80% of the shares of companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange were traded on its floor by a proprietary digital algorithm. Today, only 20% are traded there, and most of the other shares are traded on alternative systems that have cropped up, systems in which many of the old rules and regulations no longer apply, and that's at high-frequency trading. And they even mentioned that high-frequency traders have exploited these lightly regulated trading systems, and in the United States, computer-driven algorithms now execute 60% of all stock trades. One result was the flash crash on May 6th, 2010, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1,000 points in a matter of minutes. Although it recovered 600 points in the lost minutes later, the episode showed just how little we understand about high finance and how vulnerable we are to its vagaries. The internet has also made it easier to participate in the over-the-counter market derivatives. I don't know if I want to really get into the whole financial markets. Evidence is beginning to pile up that our brains cannot effectively deal with virtual environments. And this makes perfect sense. The challenge they pose is barely a half generation old, yet our minds have been shaped by other challenges that date back thousands of generations. And as we take bodies and brains adapted to physical space and immerse them in virtual worlds, they are not only unable to cope. Hold on, my eye is itching. But they respond in anticipated ways. And as Nora Volkow, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, has observed, the technology is actually rewiring our brains. And that is something that we have found in a lot of our studies. Even texting is rewiring the way our brain works. Any interaction with a device is making those chemical pathways change in our brains. We already know that physical stimuli can cause profound changes in the brain, and studies of combat veterans afflicted with post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, reveal that it produces consistent and worrying increases in the level of cortisol, and that's the stress hormone. Increasingly, we are seeing evidence of similar changes from the stress that we experience when moving from the real to the virtual worlds. Linda Stone, a former developer of interactive media for Microsoft, has studied the multitasking of those of us who sit in front of computer screens for long stretches of time. She finds that some of the cortisol-triggered responses seen in combat veterans, including elevations in heart rate and blood pressure, ding, 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 and right then and there is my Achilles heel. Some of the things, working all these years in technology, sitting in front of a computer, I never ever had blood pressure issues before. And then one day it just became a problem that maybe and potentially aided in some of my now current health problems. In a 2010 paper for the National Bureau of Economic Research, Dico Corvilio of the HEC Montreal said that his colleagues had concluded that multitasking, and by spreading your attention among many functions, hurts the overall performance. And I could second that opinion. Russell A. Podlick, a neurobiologist at the University of Texas at Austin, has similarly shown that multitasking retards learning. So worse, though, is that our brains seem to crave the virtual world, with repeated exposure producing changes that resemble drug addiction. Ding, 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 ding. Dopamine button and that GABA we just found out. And according to Gary Small, a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Los Angeles, the excitement of getting an email alert causes the release of dopamine, ding, a neurotransmitter that reinforces the behavior and thus drives us to crave much more stimulation. Before long, it becomes impossible for people to put their phones down, and dopamine's effects were shaped by natural selection. It helps to focus our attention on that one thing so that we won't be eaten by tigers. Unless, of course, you're staring at your smartphone walking through the jungles, and then you might. These days, it is fascinating. No, it is facilitating our consumption of emails and text messages. Many experts believe our internet addiction is similar to those associated with gambling, and I have dug into that and have shown that exact connection before on this show. In both cases, people find it difficult to function normally and have stable family lives or effectively work. It will be years before we fully understand the lasting effects of living in virtual worlds, but until we do, it is best to approach the situation with caution. The main challenge we face is to recognize that we are designed to reside in a slow-paced physical world. It is extremely difficult to accept. We want our news instantaneously today, and we want to be in touch with everyone at all times, and our careers depend on our being constantly available. And guys, if that is not one thing that causes a lot of stress, 24/7, every day that you weren't working and you got a message, I used to get messaged by a lot of different people, you were obligated to respond because, you know, work was paying for your cell phone or whatever. But we have to make a choice. We can design our lives so we can stay in control, or we can cede that control of our lives to the tools in our pockets. And if we choose the former path, then we are going to have to rethink the way we regulate financial markets. And in this and many other areas, we're going to have to need new and stronger laws. For example, we will need to guarantee property rights in the virtual space to protect our privacy. We will need to recognize the nature of our institutions have changed. And for many of us, a single corporation, in this case Apple, now dominates our virtual existence. Not in my life. I don't use Apple anything. Our virtual lives are bound by MacBook Airs to the north, our iPads to the south, our iPhones to the west, and our iPods to the east. And this company has more power over me, and that would be the author, than the regulated telephone companies ever did. And those used to be the big brothers. Should companies like Apple be regulated? Well, very good question. How about the Googles as well? And the Facebooks? We have also have decisions to make. For my part, I have decided to stay in control. I use the miraculous tools of the information age to augment my life in the physical space rather than live in the virtual space and use the physical world to supplement it. I'm reminded of an observation made to me a while back by John M. Staudenmayer, a historian of technology who also is a Jesuit priest. That is a very interesting combination. He pointed out that the quickest way to end a deep and meaningful conversation was to glance at your watch. What would he say today about our ever more tempting smartphones? I have to shut off all my alerts and my reminders on my computers and my smartphones, and I have to check for email on my own schedule just a few times a day. And at home, I've built a physical wall around the virtual world. And that's what my office is all about. This used to be the only place that I would touch this world. So when I went upstairs to the house, I was at home. At home, I've now let myself read news on my iPad in the house, but I answer emails and conduct business only in my office, he says. I heeded Stidenmeyer's advice and never end important conversations by glancing at my smartphone because my iPhone is never present when I am out with my wife listening to challenges my kids are facing or playing and laughing with my grandchildren. My advice to you is take control of your tools and your brain. And in that case, I promise your life will be better if you aren't constantly checking to see if you have mail. Now, here's the next step that we are going to take in the last few minutes of the show. And I still have a few more of these connections between our devices and our eyes I wanted to look at and the prefrontal cortex. Now, we read that story that we just finished reading about virtual reality and it being unhealthy and living in the virtual world. It was from 2012. They already were on to something going on. Now, this one is from 2014 from ScienceDaily.com. Exploring the brain, new findings explain how the eyes link to the prefrontal cortex, and that is that same area where we produce the dopamine reaction. This is out of Montana State University, June 24th, 2014. A research team has linked how our eyes actually see the world to neurons in the prefrontal cortex. A team studied the saccadic eye movements, that's S-A-C-C-A-D-I-C, those movements where the eye jumps from one point of focus to another in an effort to determine exactly how this happens without us being overcome by our brains processing too much visual information at one time. A Montana State University assistant professor in neuroscience is part of a team who has made progress understanding how the brain processes visual information. In addition to adding the basic understanding of the brain function, the research may also have implications for understanding schizophrenia and attention deficit disorders. Guys, are you seeing a connection here? Like, we are finding out our eyes are a connecting point. They connect directly to the brain. I had always said, don't put anything in your eye. We don't want Google having access and a direct connect to the brain. Well, I was only kind of postulating at the time, but it is seeming that my hunches may have been somewhat correct. The Montana State University scientist Benrod Nutwist was a co-author with Mark Zinak and other neuroscientists from the Trinmore Lab at Stanford University, and publishing a recent paper on their research in Nature, which is an international weekly journal for natural sciences. Nudist and his team studied saccadic eye movements, those movements where the eye jumps from one point of focus to another, in an effort to determine exactly how this happens without us being overcome by too much visual processing for our brain. To introduce the study, Nudist first got his audience to think about eye movements at the most basic level. Look in the mirror and stare in one eye, he says, and then look at the other eye. We are essentially blind during that eye movement as we cannot see our eyes move, though we know that they did. According to him, scientists have been trying to learn exactly how the brain processes these visual stimuli during saccadic eye movement, and this research now offers new evidence that the prefrontal cortex of the brain is responsible for our visual stability. Visual stability is what keeps our brain vision stable in spite of changing input, and this is similar to the stabilizer button on a video camera, says Nudist. And we wanted to know what causes the brain to filter out unnecessary information when we shift our vision from one focal target to another. Without that visual filter, the visual information may overwhelm us. According to scientists, the study offers evidence neurons in the prefrontal cortex start processing information in anticipation of where we are going to look before we even do it, suggesting that selective processing might be a mechanism for visual stability. This new information can help scientists better understand the underlying causes in mechanisms such as dyslexia and attention deficit disorder, and earlier they mentioned schizophrenia as well. Schizophrenia and attention deficit disorder have been linked to visual stability, so the work BEDRED is doing offers valuable knowledge to other scientists working in cognitive science. Understanding how a healthy brain works is important in terms of knowing the impact on cognitive functions such as memory, learning, and in this case, attention. And by exploring normal brain function, studying little mini brain balls, we can better understand what happens in someone with mental illness. I mean, this is really leading to places where we are going to find ourselves after we have all been mentally disfigured by our connected devices. They're going to have all kinds of intriguing ways to fix us with their future technologies. Now, here was one more story that I came across the other day. This is from December 5th, 2017, out of sciencenews.org. And I found this extremely interesting. Staring into your baby's eyes can put their brainwaves and yours into sync. Oh, really? Yeah. And I actually have been reading about a little bit of research about the eye and when you focus and concentrate on something. When you are having a conversation with somebody, that the two conversationists' brainwaves actually sync up as well. And this technology that we've been tinkering with takes our brainwaves out of sync. When you lock eyes with a baby, it is hard to look away. For one thing, babies are fun to look at. They're so tiny and cute and interesting. But for others, babies also love to stare back. I remember my babies, and that's the author of the story, staring at me so hard with their eyebrows raised and unblinking eyes wide open, and they would have killed me in a staring contest. This mutual adoration of staring may be for a good reason. When a baby and an adult makes eye contact, their brainwaves are in full sync, as study finds, and those shared patterns of brain activity may actually pave the way for better communications between baby and adult. Babies make more sweet little sounds with their eyes locked into an adult who is looking back. And the scientists report this study in the November 28th proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences. A bunch of scientists invited infants into the lab for two experiments. The first, the team outfitted 17 8-month-old babies with EEG caps. Oh no! Headwear covered the electrodes that measured the collective behavior of the nerve cells across their brain. And the infants watched a video in which the experimenter, also outfitted with an EEG cap, sung a nursery rhyme while looking either straight ahead or at the baby. But the baby, with their head turned at a 20-degree angle, or away from the baby with their head turned at a 20-degree angle. And when the researchers looked at the baby's brains responded, showing activity patterns that started to closely resemble those of the researcher. In the second experiment, they moved to test in real life. The researchers sat in the same room with the baby wearing an EEG, and when their eyes met, their brain waves fell into sync.